I just want to dedicate today's shiur number one to the memory of Gittel Baser of Moshe Binyamin Aleha Hashalom, whose yahrzeit is Hey Adar Beis. She should have an Aliyas Hanashama from our Divrei Torah that we will share today. A second dedication for today's shiur is for a family member of someone in our shul who's having a very, very important procedure now. And he asked that we keep her in mind in our learning that she should have Rufuah Shalema. Her name is Elisheva Bas Rachelea. She should have Rufuah Shalema and many, many healthy years going forward. And hopefully her procedure will be a successful one. So I was asked to talk a little bit about Mikra Megillah, about some of the mitzvahs hayom that we have to do on Purim. As we know, Purim is going to be next week. It's an exciting time of year, but we have a lot to talk about. So this week we're going to talk about the halachos of Mikra Megillah. Perhaps next week we will share some insights, practical takeaways that we can learn from the Megillah itself. So if you want to bring a Megillah Sester next week, you can. If you don't want to bring one, there are plenty in the back, so you don't have to. But next week we will talk about some of the lessons that we can learn practically for our times from the Megillah. Today we're just going to talk about the halacha itself and what exactly the nature of the obligation of Mikra Megillah is on Purim. And in order to understand this discussion, we take ourselves to a month from now, which is the mitzvah of Bedikas Chametz. So the Shulchan Aruch says, we have a mitzvah. Yes, it's only in a month. Sorry, everybody. So Bedikas Chametz, as we know, we have an obligation before Pesach to check our homes for Chametz. And the Shulchan Aruch there writes that on the night of Bedikas Chametz, Yizar kal Adam shelo yaschil b'shum melacha. Everyone must make sure that on the eve of Bedikas Chametz, when we have the obligation to search our homes, we should not be involved in anything else from the time that we have the obligation to do the bedika. We should not be doing any other work. We shouldn't be on the phone. We shouldn't be checking our emails. We shouldn't be making dinner. We should be involved in the bedikas chametz. Velo yochal. The Shulchan Aruch says we don't have a right to eat until we fulfill our obligation of bedikas chametz, because this is something that we need to pay very close attention to. So the Shulchan Aruch says one has to be very careful about that. So some modern-day achronim write that if a person is waiting online in the rabbi's office to go sell his chametz on the night of bedikas chametz, okay, that's a good excuse, because you're not going to forget about doing the bedika because you're involved in something that has to do with Pesach anyway. But barring that exception, we would assume that people really should not be involved in any other outside activity. Your focus right now should be on fulfilling your mitzvah bedikas chametz, and anything else that you might be doing now will take away from your attention that should be given to the mitzvah that is at hand. It should be of no surprise that we have a Gemara in Maseches Megillah. Maseches Sukkah, where the Gemara says on Daf Lamed Ches, if you have a person Mishaba Baderech, if you have somebody who's traveling, and it happens to be Chol HaMoed Sukkos, and there Lohaya Biyado Litol Lulav, and you didn't have a Lulav and Esrog with you as you were traveling, how are you supposed to get one? I was traveling on business. I wasn't able to bring it with me on the plane, so how should I have a lulav and esrog? But now I come home, and it's Chol HaMoed Sukkos, and I have the opportunity to shake the lulav. But I've also been traveling for a couple of days, and I really haven't had a nice, good meal in the last few days either. So the Gemara says, L'kisheikanis lebeso, when you come home from that trip, and you have not yet shaken the lulav, yitol al shulchano. Now, what does that mean? It means you stand up on the table and you shake the dalad minim? No. So Rashi says, what does it mean, yitol al shulchano? Rashi says it means, im shachach velo natal kodem achila. You've been traveling the last few days and you're exhausted and you're hungry and you haven't had a good meal, and you come home and somebody serves you some nice hot soup and you're sitting down to eat it, and then you remind yourself while you're in the middle of the meal, I haven't yet done my mitzvah of shaking the lulav. Says the Gemara, what it means is, Tzarech lahapsik su'udasa v'lita lalulav. You have to stop eating the soup, stop eating whatever it is that you're eating, and go immediately al shulchano, in the middle of a meal. You have to stop and go make time to shake the dalad minim, because that is your primary obligation. What it means is that when we have a mitzvah that is confronting us, when we have a mitzvah that we are expected to perform, we cannot be involved in other things at that time. We have to give our total focus to the mitzvah. And Rashi explains the reason why is because we're concerned. Sometimes you get carried away in the meal, and sometimes you're exhausted and you go to sleep, and then you don't remember to do the mitzvah that you're expected to do. And therefore, when a mitzvah opportunity comes our way, we have to make sure to do it without doing anything else in its place. Now, there's a famous discussion regarding Tkiyah Shofar on Rosh Hashanah, and I know this is going to strike a chord with some, which is fine, but it's a major controversy that's been going on for about 200 years. And the story goes as follows. It should be of no surprise when we see the Mishnah Maseches Sukkah that you're not allowed to eat before shaking the Dalet Minim, and we also have the Halacha by Bedikas Chametz in Shulchan Aruch that you're not allowed to eat before doing Bedikas Chametz. Well, that should follow the same logic that before blowing the shofar on Rosh Hashanah, one is also not allowed to eat. And yet, we know that we've been to many different communities where they have a very long davening on Rosh Hashanah morning, and they have a break sometime in the middle in order for people to go and have something to eat and have Kiddush. And then they come back and they hear the rest of davening. They hear the Tkiyah Shofar and they daven Musaf. And the question is, what is that all about? What right do we have to do that? After all, it seems to defy the logic that we apply to all other mitzvahs. So Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes the following. Kava alai nafshi. He says, I was in tremendous pain. Eich efshar lahashir sefer Torah ala bima v'lalechas habayta. How are we allowed to leave the Sefer Torah on the bima? And everyone goes home. And what are we doing at home? It's in the middle of davening on Rosh Hashanah. So you have a Sefer Torah on the bima. The shofar is sitting there. And everyone goes home kedei lekadesh v'lechal matamim, to go home and eat some crackers and have some cake. V'adayin lo kimu mitzvah sayom, and we haven't yet fulfilled our primary obligation of the day, which is shehu hisarus l'tshuva. The most important focus of the day is to blow the shofar. And as we know, the shofar is the most important tool that we have in Rosh Hashanah. And yet, says Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, everyone just leaves the shofar there, leaves the Sefer Torah on the bima, and goes home to have some cake and cookies. Really? What's the rationale? How can we be allowed to do that? This Techemed, one of the great Gedolim who lived in Yerushalayim in the 1800s, writes that he doesn't understand. He says, Shamati, can you believe? I've heard. Sheyesh mekomos etzel achenu ha-ashkenazim. He says there are some Ashkenazi communities. I happen to be a Sephardi, he says, but I've heard that in the Ashkenazi communities, on Yom Rosh Hashanah Achar Shachriz, you won't believe this, he says, on Rosh Hashanah after they daven Shachriz, Yotzim Beis HaKnesses, they leave the shul, v'shosim tea. Halavai, our kiddushes would only be tea on Rosh Hashanah. But he says, I can't believe it. They go home, they leave everything behind, and they drink a tea at home. And then he says, after they're finished with the tea and the coffee, Chozrim L'shma Kriyas HaTorah Utkios. Can you believe this? He's astounded. V'haya davar tamua be'enai. So he has this Techemed. I couldn't understand why people think they're allowed to do this. Ach, he says, k'shem she'mitzvah lomar davar ha'nishma. The same way that you're supposed to give tochacha when people are going to listen, equally as important is to know when you should keep your mouth shut. If no one's going to listen to you, just don't say anything. And therefore he says, although I cannot understand why one would be allowed to do so, I know that no one's going to listen to me, so I'll just keep quiet and I'm not going to say anything. That's what he says. And he can't understand where it comes from. In fact, I'm sure some of us in the room have heard of the great tzaddik Rav Henkin. Rav Henkin was the undisputed Gadol Hador in America before Rav Moshe Feinstein came around to these shores. So Rav Henkin, after Rav Moshe came on the scene, nobody remembered Rav Henkin any longer because Rav Moshe was Rav Moshe. But Rav Henkin was a tremendous Gadol. And it's interesting. I read an article a number of years ago about Rav Henkin. It was actually printed in the Mishpacha magazine, which I don't even get, but somebody had cut it out for me because they thought I would find it interesting, and I really did find it very interesting. So, there's a story there that they write about Rav Henkin, that he very rarely gave smicha. For some reason, he didn't feel that he should give out smicha, he didn't want to take the responsibility, but he gave, on very rare occasion, he gave smicha to a few of his very close Talmidim. But he gave it, and he said that it was dependent on three conditions. And he told them, if you violate any of these three conditions, your smicha is retroactively revoked. So I was very curious to see what were his three conditions. I would say, if you don't live up to the ethical and moral standard of whatever a rabbi should represent, and if you, I don't know. I don't know what I would have put on that list. But here's what he put on. The first one I forgot. The second one he said is, you're never allowed to make Shabbos early. Even if there's a time of year when you can make early Shabbos, you as the rabbi are never allowed to make early Shabbos. Why? Because your job as the rabbi is to be available for the people in your community. And if you're going to make Shabbos early, how do you expect everybody who went to work on Friday, and they're going to come home late, and they're going to have a shiloh right before Shabbos, and you're not going to be available? Because you already made Shabbos, and your phone is not going to be answered. So he said, rule number two is, if you violate this principle, your smicha is revoked, if you ever make Shabbos early, because as a rabbi, you have no right to do that. Thank God he didn't give me smicha. But I thought it was a very fascinating perspective, and it gives a picture of what a rabbi's job really needs to be. So that's what he said. That was condition number two. Condition number three is, if you dare allow for a kiddush on Rosh Hashanah morning in your shul before tkiyos, your smicha is retroactively revoked. And I was amazed by this. Really? Is that from the most important things that a rabbi should fight for over the year? I would say, in my opinion, I would say, I have many other things that I think we should fight for before that. But yet he said, to him, this was so important and it was so wrong what people did on Rosh Hashanah that he said, if you as the rabbi of the shul allow that to go on under your auspices, your smicha from me is revoked retroactively, and I want you to know that from now. In fact, I was talking to somebody about this, and they said that they spoke to the children of Rav Henkin, who said that on his deathbed, apparently Rav Henkin in the end had dementia or something. He didn't have his complete mind at the end. But they said in the hospital at the very end of his life, you can hear him mumbling under his breath, and don't eat before Tekiyos and Rosh Hashanah. So apparently this was something that he held very near and dear to his heart, that even in the end when he wasn't even thinking, he still was saying this because this was something that he held by very, very strongly. So what is the rationale? Why do many, many communities and many virtuous and righteous communities allow this to go on? Why is it okay? So the Talmidei HaChafetz Chaim say that in Radin they used to eat under the auspices of the Chafetz Chaim. So that's a pretty good haskama. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, who is also a very prominent figure in our history, also allowed people to eat on Rosh Hashanah before blowing the shofar. So what is the rationale? The answer that many give is because, you're right, we have a concern before Bedikas Chametz, and we have a concern before Tkiyas, before shaking lulav, that if you're going to get involved in eating, you're going to forget to do the mitzvah. On Rosh Hashanah, do you think there's anybody who's going to forget to blow the shofar? You think someone's going to go home and have Kiddush and forget to come back? Emas hadin aleihem. Everybody, they're making an assumption that everybody is so scared on Rosh Hashanah. Halavai, we would take Rosh Hashanah that seriously that we would really be as afraid, you know, who's ever going to do something wrong? My father always says that it says in Shulchan Aruch, we have a minhag on Rosh Hashanah not to eat nuts. Why? Because egos is begematria chet. So we don't eat nuts because it's the same gematria. My father always tells us, chet is also begematria chet. If you do an aveira on Rosh Hashanah, it's also pretty bad. But most people don't think about that. You know, we talk the Lashon Hara on Rosh Hashanah like we do during the year, and we, whatever, you know, not everybody's so afraid. So the understanding was that in the Chafetz Chaim's yeshiva, I guess, everybody was so afraid of Rosh Hashanah, who would dare ever forget to blow the shofar? No one's going to forget to come back, and therefore there is no concern about allowing people to go and have some Kiddush. This will give them energy to finish off the davening properly and to be able to concentrate, and therefore they felt that it was something that was allowed. Interestingly, we know that when a couple gets married, there is a widespread practice that the chasen and the kala fast on the day of the wedding. And the question is why? Where does that come from? So the general answer that's given is because we know that the day of the wedding is a day of mechilas avonos. Now make no mistake, it doesn't mean if the chasen and kala have done all kinds of averus in their lives, magic, now you get married, everything's gone. No. The Gemara has the same kind of statement. Somebody who walks dalet amos in Eretz Yisrael gets a mechilas avonos. Really? So does that mean I can eat on Yom Kippur, and I can go ahead and be Mechal Shabbos, and I can do all kinds of Averis, and I can eat non-kosher food, and as long as I walk at some point in my life four Amos and Eretz Yisrael, everything's fine. The Ribbono Shel Olam will let me get away with it? No, that's not what it means. What it means is, if I'm also engaged in the process of tshuva, and along the way I also happen to be in Eretz Yisrael, and I walked out Amos, that will help assist me in the process of tshuva moving along quicker than it otherwise would have. And the same goes for a chasen and kala. My father told me the day of my wedding, don't think this is just a magical pass. You know, you get married and therefore we assume you get a mechilas avonos. No. If you're maharer b'tshuva, if you take it seriously and you understand that the day of your wedding is a very important time in your life, and because of that you take all of life seriously and you understand that this is an opportunity for you to think seriously about tshuva as well, then it will help the fact that today is also the day of your wedding and therefore you get a mechilas avonos. So, because we assume that there's something auspicious about the day that one gets married, therefore we assume that that is the reason why many chasanim and kalos fast. A second reason is because they suggest maybe it's because we don't want that anyone should turn around later on and say, I didn't really want to marry her, I didn't really want to marry him, and I was forced into it, and I wasn't really thinking straight, and I had too much to drink beforehand. So what we say is, nobody can come later on with any excuses. You weren't drunk, you weren't high on anything, you didn't eat all day. When he asked you if he wants to marry you and you said yes and you accepted the opportunity to be married to this man, you did it because you decided you wanted to do it. And don't come to us later on and say, oh, I had something to drink and I wasn't thinking straight, I didn't really want to marry him. No. We assume the couple got married, and the way to prove that is chasen and kala don't eat the day of their wedding, that nobody can turn around and say, I didn't really accept at the time because I wasn't really thinking straight. Okay, those are two different reasons given. This day Chemed quotes in the name of one of the Rishonim, the Rokeach. He says, no, it has nothing to do with Mechilas Avonos. It has nothing to do with being drunk. Come on, who's going to show up to the wedding drunk? Rather, he says, the reason why is very simple. The same way you're not allowed to eat before you do any mitzvah, before you blow the shofar, and the same way you're not allowed to eat before you shake the lulav, and before you do bedikas chametz, you're not allowed to eat before you do the mitzvah of getting married. If you're supposed to get married today, then there's no right that you have to eat, because maybe you'll forget about getting married. Now, I would say most of us wouldn't forget. But most of us wouldn't forget bedikas chametz either, or shaking lulav. And yet, we have a mitzvah, we have a din that you're not allowed to eat before doing a mitzvah because we have a concern. So writes the Stei Chemed, this is the same. And in fact, the Pischei Tshuva and Yeridei and Hilchus Bris Milah writes the following. Sometimes you have a Bris Milah that doesn't happen early in the morning. If you have a child who is sick, so the Bris Milah happens later. Or very often we know the practice is, today, very widespread, that we do a Pidyon HaBen later in the day. Not always is a Pidyon HaBen done early in the morning. It's a good question why that's allowed. Usually we say Zrizim Akdim on the mitzvah, so mitzvah should be done right away, whatever. Many people make a Pidyon HaBen later in the day, and it's perfectly acceptable. That's what many communities do. And the Pischei Tshuva writes, if you happen to be the father of that child who's having the Bris Milah at 4 o'clock in the afternoon or the Pidyon HaBen in the afternoon, you also are not allowed to eat during the day because you have a mitzvah that you have an obligation to fulfill, and you have not yet done your mitzvah. So this is what the Pischei Tshuva writes, that before we do the mitzvah that we have to do, we have to make sure not to eat. And the same goes by the Magen Avraham, who tells us by Neres Chanukah that we're not allowed to eat before we do the mitzvah of Hadlakas Neres Chanukah, which runs us into a major problem every year. Every year, inevitably, anybody here has ever been to a wedding on Chanukah, one night of Chanukah? So we have weddings almost every night of Chanukah, every single year. And the problem is, what are we supposed to do? What right do we have to participate in a wedding? Now, let me just put this out there. You get no mitzvah at all lighting Chanukah candles in the wedding hall. Zero. It's not your house. It's nothing to do with you. It makes it look and feel like Chanukah, which is very nice, but it's nothing. So don't fool yourself. Lighting the Chanukah candles in the wedding hall does nothing. You have to light Chanukah candles at home. Now, in many families, there's one member of the family that's going to be at home, so they light Chanukah candles on behalf of everybody else who happens not to be home, so that's good enough. That's fine. That's okay. If you have a spouse or you have a child who's old enough, they light Chanukah candles. Officially, the mitzvah is ner ishu beso. Officially, the mitzvah is each household should have a Chanukah candles lit. So you really take care of your obligation. And then when you come home from the wedding, maybe you light again, maybe not, whatever. But how many of us don't have that kind of luxury? Don't have a person at home who could light for us? And the problem is, what are we supposed to do? You can't always light earlier before you leave. And you don't want to leave the candles lit in the house, which you shouldn't leave them in the house without being there, because that's a very irresponsible thing to do. But the question is, what are we supposed to do? We don't have a right to be involved in other things before doing our mitzvah of Neres Chanukah. It's a major problem. I don't know if it's happened to you, but I know many people who it has happened to, that they come home from a wedding and they're very exhausted. So I was just at a wedding on Sunday night. Someone in the shul made a wedding in New Jersey. By the time I came home, it was late at night already. It was an hour and 15 minute drive to get there. And it was an exhausting day. And by the time you come home, you're exhausted. And I had a shiur to prepare, and I had some sleep to try to sleep before my kids were going to wake me up, you know, shortly thereafter. And sometimes it's very easy, if that happens on Chanukah, to just forget about the whole thing, and you haven't lit Chanukah candles, and you wake up 2 o'clock in the morning, and you realize, what do I do now? So you have to be careful about this. And what the Magen Avraham says is not so silly. What the Magen Avraham says about not eating before Neres Chanukah and being involved in other things is something that we should actually think about. Now, when it comes to Purim, this is a much more difficult challenge. Because in Shulchan Aruch it says, the Rama writes, that one is not allowed to eat on Purim before performing the mitzvah of Mikra Megillah. The problem is that we have Tainus Esther right before Mikra Megillah. So it becomes very difficult. This is not the same as every other mitzvah. This is, we've been fasting a whole day, and then until we finish the Megillah, it's going to be another, I don't know how long it takes in everyone's shuls that they go to, but it could be another 30, 40 minutes. Until you get out of shul, it's a whole balagan. So it's not so easy to fast for another extra hour, especially now that we change the clocks. It means you're fasting till, I don't know what time, 8 o'clock at night. It's not going to be so easy. So the Rama says, really, one is not supposed to eat until after Mikra Megillah is completed. Until after Mikra Megillah is completed, one is not really supposed to eat. So the Magen Avraham has a little caveat there, and he says, look, if you're very weak and you're really not feeling well and you think you're not going to be able to pay attention to the Megillah, and the whole time you're just going to be worrying about how hungry you are and how distracted you are because of it, so then he says you should go and have something to drink, you should have something small, and don't be involved in a big meal, because that really is the prohibition. But if one is feeling just hungry, you know, all of us feel hungry after a fast day. So then the Rama says, really, one should be careful not to eat before hearing the Megillah, because that would fall in line with all the other examples that we've given about not eating before blowing the shofar, not eating before shaking the lulav, not eating before lighting Hanukkah candles, and everything else that we've mentioned until this point. The same would apply to the mitzvah of Mikra Megillah as well. Now, so we figured out when we're supposed to eat. We figured out that you're not supposed to do it before Mikra Megillah. Now, we move on to the next issue, and that is, where should I choose to hear the Megillah being read? Which sounds like a silly question, because I have a shul that I daven in throughout the year. So why would I assume that there should be any other factor involved in hearing the Megillah somewhere else? So let's just give a little bit of background. They have a concept in halacha referred to as Berov Am Hadras Melech. Now, what's confusing about this is that the Gemara uses this terminology in three different contexts, and it actually means three different things. It's a problem today, because many people, when they have a question, they Google the answer, which I think is incorrect for many reasons. Number one, because you have no idea who's writing the answer on the other line. So you can Google the answer, but maybe it's a rabbi who knows, or not a rabbi, who just knows nothing and just saw one thing and doesn't really know the context of what they saw. So it's a good question as to who we should trust and who we shouldn't. And if you don't know the person on the other line who's writing whatever they write, you have to be mindful of that. But aside from that issue, sometimes people will try to Google an answer, but they don't understand that the answer that's being given might have the same words, but it means something very different. The context is totally different. So here's one of those examples. Let's say the Gemara uses the concept called chazaka. The Prima Gadam writes that it means 10 different things in 10 different sugyas and shas. So just because you do a word search and you find that it says chazaka all over the place, it means very different contexts in many different mesechtas. So you have to be careful about this over here as well. Berov Am Hadras Melech means three different things in three different contexts. Number one, the Gemara gives us an example on Pesach. Everybody had to come Erev Pesach and bring the Karban Pesach in the Beis HaMikdash. Sheniska, this year we should have the opportunity to do that. That was the highlight of the year, says the Gemara, when people used to come to the Beis HaMikdash en masse and everybody would offer their Karban Pesach. But the problem is, it was so crowded. Imagine how many people. So let's say you have a few million Jews. How many Jews are there in the world today? 14 million Jews? Okay. How many of them are going to bring Karban Pesach? I don't know. Let's say 14 million are going to bring Karban Pesach. Halavai, 14 million are going to bring Karban Pesach. So there aren't going to be 14 million, because each Karban Pesach, let's say, has 20 people that are going to eat from it. So you only need one for 20 people. So do the math. How many people is that? I don't know. What? A little less than a million. So imagine, you have a million people. Best case scenario. You have a million people showing up on Erev Pesach. And when are you able to offer the Karban Pesach? Very small window of time. It can only start from Chatzos, from the afternoon of Pesach, and it has to end by Shkia. So you just have a few hours of when you can offer the Karban Pesach with a million karbanos that have to be brought. Complicated. How do we do this? So the Gemara says, great idea. They made an assembly line in the Beis HaMikdash. What did they do? They had one. They had a Jew who stood there by the door of the Beis HaMikdash. He came to the first kohen that he bumped into. Kohen did the Shechita. There was another kohen standing next to him who accepted the blood in a cup. Then he passed down the cup to the next kohen, to the next one, to the next one, to the next one. This way nobody had to walk anywhere. And the last person standing next to the Mizbeach would pour it onto the Mizbeach. Then they had a line going the other way where they would pass back the Kli, and you're out. You're done. And that's the way they would do it. Says the Gemara, wouldn't it be more respectful if I started the job and I finished it? If I was the one who did the Shechita, then did the job on my own, brought it to the Mizbeach, took care of everything that had to be done, and then told the guy that he was finished. No, says the Gemara, because Berov Am Hadras Melech. The more people that we have participating in one big mitzvah that needs to be done, if I can pass it to more people along the way, that enhances the mitzvah. That shows that I care more about the mitzvah when I allow more people to participate in the mitzvah that has to be done. That is the first place where we find the idea of Berov Am Hadras Melech. It's problematic for the following reason. We have a pasuk in Parshas Ekev where we're told, Kol HaMitzvah Asher Anochi Mitzavcha Hayom Tishmerun La'asos. All the mitzvahs that I've commanded you today, you should be vigilant, you should be careful, and you should make sure that you observe all of them. Now, Rashi writes there, what does it mean? Tishmerun la'asos, you should make sure to do it. Of course, if God commanded you to do it, you should do it. Rashi says it means, im ischalta b'mitzvah, gemar osa. If you've started the process of a mitzvah, It's your job to make sure to finish it. Don't hand it off to someone else while you're in the middle. You should show that you're excited about it. If you're excited enough, then you will make sure to follow it through until its completion. Well, ask the Binyan Shlomo, if that's really the standard that we expect of people, that when you start a mitzvah, and you're engaged in the process of doing a mitzvah, you should make sure to finish it off and complete it till the end, then how do you understand this Gemara? The Gemara says the Kohen who shechted stopped his job in the middle, handed it off to someone else, who handed it off to someone else, and keeps getting more people involved. What's the right thing to do? Should we do it ourselves, or should we engage many others in doing the mitzvah together with us? Anyway, it's not a sugya for now, it's for another time, but that is the first time that we find Berov Am Hadras Melech, and it means when I have one mitzvah that I need to do, I have to make sure to engage as many people as I possibly can, because that will be an enhancement of the mitzvah itself. Place number two where we find it is, when I have a mitzvah that I as an individual need to do, it's my own personal mitzvah, nobody else's business, it's something that I need to do, I should do it in the presence of many. So for example, if I'm making a bris milah, nobody else in the room has the obligation of bris milah. It's my job as a father to give a bris milah to my child. Well, the more people that I have assembled in the shul at the time that the milah is being done, the greater the mitzvah is, because it enhances whatever mitzvah I am doing. So the Gemara says in Maseches Yuma Daf Ayin, once a year the Kohen Gadol had an obligation to read from a Sefer Torah. On Yom Kippur, he had to take out a Sefer Torah and read in front of everyone. So the Gemara says, even though it seems that it's the obligation of the Kohen Gadol himself, it is not the obligation of the Jewish community, it's his obligation. The more people that would pack the Beis HaMikdash to come listen to him, the greater enhancement of the mitzvah that it was, because Berov Am Hadras Melech. Similar to what the Medrash writes, once a year there was a mitzvah of Tziras HaOmer, means they had to cut down the stalks in order to use them for the mitzvah of Karban HaOmer that was brought in the Beis HaMikdash. So it says, Kal HaAyaros HaSmuchos, all of the neighboring towns to wherever they decided to cut down the stalks of wheat from, all the neighbors would come out to the fields to watch the Kohanim do it. Why? What do they need to stand there for? Everybody's busy. And the answer, says the Medrash, is because Berov Am Hadras Melech. It shows that we're respectful to the mitzvah. It shows how happy we are to do it. And this is another application of the din of Berov Am Hadras Melech. But number three, the place we have it, which is relevant to us, is in the third context. That is the Gemara Maseches Brachos, Daf Nun Gimel. So says the Gemara, picture the scene in your mind. We have a Beis Medrash of Talmidim all sitting around and learning, and everyone's very diligent, everyone's very studious and careful not to waste any time. Comes Matzah Shabbos, everybody davens Maariv, and it always takes a few minutes to set up the Havdalah. Where's the wine, where's the candle, where's the Basal? It happens in every house, and it certainly happens in the yeshiva, where nobody takes responsibility for anything, so it takes a few minutes to figure out how to get the Havdalah together. So nobody wants to waste time. So what do? Right after Maariv, everybody sits down to learn again, and whoever's in charge there will go looking for whatever needs to be done in order to have the Havdalah provided for them. So says the Gemara, everybody's sitting there, and now, finally, the Gabbai gets all the things he needs together, and he has the candle, he has the Besamim, he has the Havdalah, he's ready to go. What should be done now? We have two options. Beis Shammai says, we should go to each person individually, give him the Besamim, give him the candle, give him the Havdalah, and say, make Havdalah and go to the next person. That is the least waste of time for everybody. Why? Because if I have to wait till everybody gets quiet, and I'm going to have to wait for everybody else to finish doing their fingers and smelling the Besamim, it's going to take me much longer. It's going to take away time from my learning. So the best, most time-efficient way to do this is go to every person, say, make your own Havdalah and pass it to the next guy. That's the opinion of Beis Shammai. Beis Hillel says, why would you do that? Berov Am Hadras Melech. If we all in the room have an obligation to make Havdalah, why not just have one person do it on behalf of all of us? Won't that be an enhancement of the mitzvah when one person does the mitzvah on behalf of all those who are assembled in the room? So that's what the Gemara says. And we paskin like Beis Hillel that is the preferred option. So you'll notice, in most houses, many Hasidim have a different minhag, but in most Litvisha houses, the minhag is that on Friday night or Shabbos day, when you have to make Kiddush, one person, one member of the family makes Kiddush on behalf of everyone. Because Berov Am Hadras Melech. That's the assumption that we have. Why do some have the practice that everybody makes is a good question. But generally we assume that when everybody in the room has an obligation to fulfill a mitzvah, if we designate together one person who can do it on behalf of all of us, that is an enhancement of the mitzvah, and it makes it better for all of us, and it makes our mitzvah better as well. So on Leil HaSeder, I know I'm making everyone nervous talking about Pesach, But on Leil HaSeder, what is, just by show of hands, I'm curious, there's no right or wrong answer. There are two different minhagim that people have. So I know what's done in my family, I'm curious what's done in your family. So on the night of the Seder, you have a whole magid that needs to be said. Does one person recite the magid and everybody listens, or does everybody say along? Those who have the practice that everybody says along, raise your hands. Okay. And those who have the practice that one person says, raise your hands. Just one? Okay, two, thank you. Okay. So, both of them are very legitimate practices. We have a mitzvah of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, which means we need to say the story of coming out of Mitzrayim. So in my family, the way it worked was, my father always used to say the Haggadah and he would lead the discussion. People always ask me, what did your father used to talk about at the Seder? And it's funny, because all he did was talk about the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. It's pretty simple. No chachmas. My father always, as children, just used to explain to us. One thing that was very unique about my father's Seder, I know he's still alive, but this year is the first time he's not making his own Seder. He's going to some of his kids. So, what was always very unique about my parents' Seder is my father is very medaktik on the Zmanim. So officially, you're supposed to be finished everything by Chatzos. Officially. So I remember always coming in after Pesach, the first day after Pesach, when school started again, and the teachers always used to ask, what time did you finish the Seder? And everyone's like, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, and I'm always like, 11:30, you know. So everybody would look at me like, what goes on in the Shechter house? You know, you guys don't do Pesach? So my father was always very careful to finish everything by Chatzos. And because of that, he always told us, it's very nice that you prepared your gematrias and your things and your whatever you prepared in school. Tomorrow morning is also Pesach. So he would tell us that we should say it at the meal during the day, which, by the way, is just a good idea anyway, because the Pesach Seder just gets out of control with everyone's gematrias that really often don't enhance anything. So, you know, you have to think about what you're going to say at the Seder. Again, you can't take away the opportunity from children, but it could be you can lead the conversation in a way that might be a little bit more meaningful than some of the things that our children are taught in school. Perhaps. I don't know. But that's what my father always encouraged us to do, and that was the way it was. So, Leil HaSeder, actually what my father always does do at the Seder, which is always a very important thing, and I think most people probably don't think about it. Leil HaSeder is really supposed to be Leil HaEmunah. It's a time for us to really remind ourselves of our Emunah. It's referred to by many as the night of our faith. So, my father, throughout the Haggadah, would point out where we have an expression of the Yud Gimel Ikari HaEmunah, the 13 principles of faith of the Rambam. He would go through the Haggadah and show us how this is an expression of all the different things that the Rambam speaks about, and that's really what the night is all about. So that's what he used to often try to infuse into our Pesach Seder, that we should remind ourselves of what the principles of faith actually are, and what the Seder is supposed to represent for ourselves and for our children. Leaving that aside, so our minhag in the house always was that my father would lead the discussion and he would say it, but all of us always would say it along. Because that's really the mitzvah, that everybody should say it. However, the Minchas Chinuch says, why should this be different than Kiddush on Friday night? When one person says it on behalf of everyone else, why can't the member of the household that is designated be the one to say the entire Haggadah and everybody else will just listen along? As long as they're paying attention, it should be fine. And in fact, the Vilna Gaon writes, that should be the preferred option. Because Berov Am Hadras Melech. That's what the Gemara says in other places. So why would you say that Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim would be any different? So this is an interesting issue. And the Tosefta writes the following. The Tosefta says, Asara Shahayu Osim Eser Mitzvos. Let's say we're all in a room. And all 10 of us have to do 10 different mitzvos. So you have to be Mafish Challah. And the person next to you has to be mafish chumas and maestros, and I have to hang up a mezuzah, and the other one needs to put on tefillin, and someone else needs to put on a talis. Everybody happens to be in one room at the same time, all doing different things. So says the Tosefta, obviously, kal echad ve'echad mevarach le'atzmo. I have to make my own bracha on the tefillin, and you have to make your own bracha on the hafrashas challah, because we're all doing different things. Of course, I can't just make one long bracha that includes everything. That's not going to work. However, hayu osim kulam mitzvah achas, what if all of us in the room, we have a challah bake? And all of us are being mafresh challah at the same time. So then says the Tosefta, the preferred option is, echad mevarech lekulam. We should designate one person who will make the bracha on behalf of all of us, lehafresh challah min ha'isa, because berov am hadras melech. It is better when all of us in the room have one obligation, just like we do by Kiddush and Havdalah on Shabbos, so too we should do whenever we have a mitzvah that we're all doing together, one person should make the bracha, And all of us should just answer Amen, have in mind to be Yotze, and that will be good enough. So, how does that apply to our discussion here? The Gemara has a very startling statement. We know... What? Yeah. So that's a good question. So let's say, forget Hallel, because it only comes a few times a year. The question is, why is it that when we say Hallel, why is it that everybody says Hallel on their own, and we don't just listen to one person say it? Let me just back up the question a little bit. Not that it's not a good question, but let me give a more common example. So let's say we have every Shabbos we have to bench after a meal. So why doesn't one person bench and everybody will listen? Doesn't that make sense? Right? And the answer that's given by the Acharonim is, you're right. That is what should have been done. Problem is, we all know that our attention span, to pay attention, it's not a joke, it's true, to listen and pay attention from the beginning of benching till the end, and hear every word, and actually have in mind that I want to be Yotze with that person and understand everything that they're saying, is a tall order. To listen just for Kiddush, okay, it's two paragraphs, we can do that, we can handle it, we can manage it. But to expect a person to listen to the entire benching or to the entire Hallel is something that's a little bit more difficult to do. Well, Lel HaSeder, I would say, is also a little bit hard to do, but, you know, it's a good question, yeah.
I see where there's no bracha that you're saying, so that nobody would say amen. It's not like you're saying a bracha. How is he put it in?
That actually leads to a very good question. Maybe we'll talk about it Pesach time. By a show of hands, I'm just curious now that we're into this. I don't know how many weeks we have in between Purim and Pesach. I know that sounds very scary. What? No, I understand. Yes. I know that from Tesvav to Tesvav is 4 weeks. I got that. I meant I don't know how many weeks of Shir we're going to have. So one of the weeks in between Purim and Pesach, Rabbi Billet on Tuesday morning is giving his annual Kashrus Shir that he gives and whatever it is about Pesach. So we are not going to. So we're not going to have our Shir in order that everybody should be able to go to his. But the question is, how many other weeks we have? Maybe two or three, I don't know. Is it better that we do Halacha and Pesach stuff instead of Pirkei Avos? I think we should put Pirkei Avos on the back burner for now. Okay, so this week we're doing Hilchos Purim. Next week we'll do Hashkafa on Purim from the Megillah. And then following that we'll do Pesach topics, and then maybe after that we'll figure out. But let's just get back to where we are. You wanted to know about the Haggadah. Maybe in one of our Haggadah Shirim we'll talk about the fact that why is there no bracha on the mitzvah of Sipri Yetzias Mitzrayim? It's very strange. Why do we not make a bracha? We make a bracha on everything else. So why is there no bracha on Leil HaSeder? Vitzivanu, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us the mitzvah of Lesaper B'tzias Mitzrayim on Leil HaSeder. That is a mitzvah de'araisa according to all opinions. So how could it be that we don't have a bracha on this mitzvah? It's a very good question. Very good question. Hold on a few weeks and we'll get back to it. So, back to our story here by Mikra Megillah. The Gemara says, as we know, Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam. Learning Torah is very important, and that's the premium. However, it says, Mevadlin Talmud Torah Lishmoer Mikra Megillah. Which means, you have a guy sitting and learning in his yeshiva, and he knows how to lay in the Megillah, and he can sit there and open up a Megillah lane by himself and go back to his learning, not waste any time. However, the Gemara says, it's inappropriate to do that. Mevadlin Talmud Torah Lishmoer Mikra Megillah. We force even the guy who's sitting and learning and doing something important, instead of sitting by himself or even with a small group of friends in the Beis Medrash and reading the Megillah and going back to learn, we make all of them come to shul in order that they should be able to do it Berov Am Hadras Melech. We want the maximum number of people reading the Megillah together because of Pirsumei Nisa. So when you're making a decision where you're going to hear the Megillah on Leil Purim, remember the fact that Berov Am Hadras Melech is a very important factor. So much so that the Gemara even says, Afilo kohanim ba'avodasam uluvim biduchanam mevadlin ha'avoda l'shmoa mikra megillah. So in the times when we have a Beis HaMikdash, and it's Leil Purim, or it's the day of Purim, and we have to read the Megillah, and we can have a minyan here in the Beis HaMikdash, do it, and get it done with, and get back to work. No. We put up a sign in the Beis HaMikdash that says, the kohanim now have to go to the shul down the block, where most people are going to be, and even if it means that the avoda is not going to take place, too bad. So when you're making the decision, should I go to the little house minyan in my luxurious basement, or should I go to shul to hear it with many other participants, make the right decision. However, the Mishnah Berurah does write, if you cannot hear in the shul, because there's too much noise and you're going to be distracted and there's going to be kids, or if it's going to distract you because you don't get along with the people in the shul and you like the people in the other shul, whatever. If you have all other factors involved, it's a different story. Or you have an elderly parent at home who can't get out and you want to have a little crowd there for them. I understand. All the other factors are things you have to contend with. But all things being equal, meaning, I dislike both communities equally. Or I love both communities equally. Or I like the Baal Kori here and I like the Baal Kori there. Or I don't like either of them. Either way, if all factors are equal, then the Shulchan Aruch says you should choose the maximum number of people that you can go hear it with because of Berov Hadras Melech. Let's move on. The next question is, who is obligated in the mitzvah of Mikra Megillah? After all, we know we have a principle in the Gemara in Kiddushin, mitzvah saseh shehazman grama. When you have a time-bound mitzvah, normally we assume that women are not obligated to perform those mitzvahs. By the way, by a show of hands, how many people, not a show of hands, how many mitzvahs do you think are encompassed in that category? What would you say? Some people think like 100. No, it's like less than 10. Maybe 7 or 8. Maybe. So the whole concept, the Rambam writes in one of his commentaries, he says, there are more exceptions to the rule than the rule itself. It says that women are not obligated to keep time-bound mitzvahs. They obviously have a right to volunteer if they want to, but they're not held accountable for those mitzvahs. In the end of the day, when all is said and done, there's only 7 or 8 mitzvahs that they're exempt from. So there's not so many in the list. I would have said that Mikra Megillah should be one of them. It's a mitzvah saseh shehazman grama. And if there's any busy time, it's certainly on Purim. Who has time to go to shul and listen to the Megillah? We're running around doing everything that has to be done. And yet, women are obligated in Mikra Megillah. Why? Says the Gemara, because af hein hayu ba'osa hanes. Or like the Yerushalmi says, af hein hayu ba'osa hasafik. What did Haman HaRosha say? Lahashmid laharog la'abed es kol ha'yudim. Haman said, I want to destroy the entire Jewish community, men and women equally. He did not distinguish between genders, and therefore, because men and women were equally involved in the danger, therefore we have an equal obligation to commemorate the Hatzalah, to commemorate the salvation that we had many, many generations ago. And therefore we assume both men and women are obligated in Mikra Megillah. Now, when do we have an obligation to read the Megillah? The Gemara says that we have an obligation both at night and then once again in the morning. These are considered two separate obligations. I've been surprised that people have called me that they didn't realize that there were two separate obligations. So some women had gone to shul at night and didn't realize that you should try to go to shul again in the morning to hear it. This is something that both men and women have an obligation to fulfill at night and once again in the morning. The next question you need to ask yourself is, what is the definition of morning? So we know that Purim is a very, very busy day. So just for those of us who have children coming, or for those of us who are making a Purim Suda, or for those of us who are just delivering Shalach Manas, it's a very busy day. And everybody has so many things, and the day goes by very quickly. Or for those of us who have to go to work on Purim, and will only come home later to have the Purim Suda. I know many people who do have to go to work on Purim. So it would be very helpful to them if they were able to get the day started earlier and read the Megillah as early as possible. Now, how early is acceptable? The Mishnah Maseches Megillah writes, Kol hayom kasher lekriyas haMegillah. The entire day of Purim is acceptable to read the Megillah. Ulekriyas haHallel. On all those days when we have to read Hallel, you can read Hallel for the entire duration of the day. I had a Shiloh a couple of months ago. Fascinating question. A student in medical school who just started his rotation, and he was doing a shift 7 to 7, and he was extremely exhausted. He came home. After his shift was over, he went straight to shul to daven. Quickly, he came late to the minyan, he quickly davened. He was so exhausted right after he davened his quiet Shmoneh Esrei, he took off his tefillin and he went home to sleep. He didn't stay for the rest of davening. He slept during the afternoon. He had a shift again that night. So he went to daven Mincha and Ma'ariv in shul. Now normally, Mincha and Ma'ariv is right before the Shkia. It's like 5 minutes, 10 minutes before the Shkia. So he calls me 5 minutes before the Shkia. What was his problem? He was in shul and he heard the Gabbai make an announcement, Rosh Chodesh, Yalav Yavo. And he says, oh my goodness, I was so exhausted this morning, I didn't realize. So now he has a lot of problems because he's 5 minutes before the Shkia and he realizes he has to do a makeup Shmona Esrei for Shachris because he didn't say Alevi Yavo. He has to daven Musaf because he didn't daven Musaf this morning. He has to say Hallel. He has to now daven Mincha and he only has 5 minutes. So what should he do? He's not going to be able to say everything, or at least I hope not. So what gives? So maybe it wasn't nice, but I listened to his message, and I had no idea what the answer was. So I didn't answer him. I called him like 10 minutes after Shkia. I'm like, great question. I don't know. What'd you do? You know? I assumed he'll just decide to do something. And I looked into the question. It was a very good one. It's actually a very good question. But the Gemara here lays down the rule. When you have a mitzvah of, let's say, Mikra Megillah, or a mitzvah of Halal, or a mitzvah of shaking the lulav, you can do it throughout the entire duration of the day until the Shkia. Once the Shkia comes, then you have no more opportunity to do it. But when does the day begin? So the Mishnah writes in Maseches Megillah that you have to wait until Hanetzachama. Hanetzachama means sunrise. So really, is that the beginning of a halachic day? Sunrise? What would you say? When does the halachic day begin? Not the night before, no. When does a daytime begin? Alos HaShachar. When is Alos HaShachar? 72 minutes before sunrise. When you start seeing the shades of the sun, something, you start seeing light, things change in the sky, then that's already Alos HaShachar. So what do you mean? A daytime starts only with the rising of the sun? Shouldn't it start way earlier? So Rashi says, well, really you're right. Really the halachic day begins by Alos HaShachar. However, he says, because people aren't really going to know exactly when that is, because we don't have precise times, therefore he says, everybody assumes that the daytime starts when the sun rises, because that's something that everyone can see. So you can't make a mistake about that. And therefore we assume that all of these mitzvahs that have to be done during the day, you can only start them at Hanetzachama. So based on that, this Techemet says, maybe we should argue that today, where we all have watches and atomic clocks, and everybody knows exactly what time it is at all times, maybe we should say today that we have a right to start doing these mitzvahs already at Alos HaShachar. So the Techemet writes in the name of his good friend, the Yaderis. Who is the Yaderis? The father-in-law of Rav Kook. He was great before Rav Kook married his daughter, but that's when he became super famous. So the Yaderis was the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim. He was a friend of the Techemet. He said that there were many communities in Europe. He was the Av Beis Din in Panevish before he moved to Yerushalayim. So the Yaderis writes that there were a number of communities where came Sukkot time, and they only had one set of Dalet Minim for the whole community. Nobody could afford to have their own. So they had to take shifts, and everybody came and shook the Dalet Minim and put it down and gave it to the next person. But if you have a large community, it takes time. You only have a limited amount of time. So they used to have, early in the morning, people used to start shaking the Dalet Minim already from Alos HaShachar. The Yaderis says, what do you mean? They don't know the Mishnah Megillah that says you have to wait till Hanetzachama, says the Yaderis. Maybe the rationale is, since today everybody has watches and clocks, and we know exactly what time it is, and no one's going to make a mistake, so maybe we have a right to say that in our times, when everybody knows with precision exactly what time it is, the halachic day already starts from when it's supposed to start, which is Alos HaShachar. That's the argument that some make. Rav Moshe Feinstein doesn't like it, and he says, no, a halachic day really is supposed to start by Hanetzachama. Unless you have very extenuating circumstances, you really should not try to do these mitzvahs before that time, which today is very difficult, now that we moved the clock. So Hanetzachama is very late. Hanetzachama this morning was like 7 o'clock. So there are many people who want to daven early on Purim to get things going. You want to go to the 6 o'clock minyan. Unless you have very extenuating circumstances, that is something that really you should try not to do. But if, again, if you have to do something important, everybody has to judge what is considered very important. So then obviously that is something that b'diavad you would be able to fulfill your mitzvah, but l'chatchila, it is not something that should be done. Because we know that women have an obligation to read the Megillah equally to the obligation of men, we sometimes have gatherings in private homes in order that women should be able to come hear the Megillah instead of having to go to shul. Now, there is a question: when you do the Mikra Megillah in a home, which brachas are supposed to be said when it's only being done for women? That is a very good question. So let's just back up a step. How many brachas do we say on the Megillah before we read it? 3. What are the brachas? Al Mikra Megillah. We make a second bracha of Shechiyanu. And a third bracha of She'asa Nisim. Those are the 3 brachas. So the last 2, Shechiyanu, She'asa Nisim, men and women will make equally. There's no doubt about it, of course. Shechiyanu we make because it's Purim. After all, the same way we make a Shechiyanu on Rosh Hashanah and Sukkot and Pesach and everything else, so we make a Shechiyanu on Purim as well. Women should say Shechiyanu without a doubt. She'asa Nisim we say because we commemorate the great miracle. Hashem made miracles for us, now He makes miracles today as well. Great, we're going to celebrate Sei She'asa Nisim. Sounds wonderful. What about the first bracha of Al Mikra Megillah? That is a big dispute amongst the Rishonim. Why? Why is it a dispute? Is a very good question. There were some who felt, and let me just say this is not relevant to our generation today, but you understand if you take the context of what women's lives were like in Europe 150, 200 years ago, you understand where it's coming from. There were some Achronim who said, how can we make a bracha asher kedushanu mitzvos of itzivanu al mikra megillah when we lay in only for the women? Not a single woman in the room has a clue what we're reading. The women in those days were not educated, and many of them were illiterate, and they had no understanding of what was being said. They couldn't follow. So why should we make a bracha al mikra megillah when we're not really doing anything? Nobody knows what's being said. Now, obviously, it's not relevant today. In our communities, where the women are very highly educated and know exactly what's going on when they come to shul and they want to do the mitzvah, so of course that's not a factor. But it's interesting that only 200 years ago, this was something that was considered. And many Acharonim said, it just doesn't make sense to make a bracha if no one in the room knows what's going on. So again, what? The Baal Kori already read in shul. So, whatever. So again, you're correct. If the Baal Kori didn't yet read, so of course he makes the bracha for himself. But again, this is not a factor that we have to contend with today, because the women who come to your Mikra Megillah today obviously know what the Megillah stands for, what it represents, and what they know how to follow along the words. There's no doubt about that. However, there were some who said that when a woman's Megillah is being done, the Rama writes that the women should really make a separate bracha, and that is the bracha of Lishmoa Megillah. Instead of saying Al Mikra Megillah, they should make the bracha Lishmoa Megillah. The Bach and some others disagree. So again, you shouldn't be surprised if you go to one of these readings of Megillah in a home where the man already heard Megillah in shul and now they're just doing a second reading for the women in the house. Don't be surprised if you hear the bracha lishma Megillah. That is what the Ramah says. The Svardim don't follow this practice. The Svardim say, make the regular bracha likra Megillah the same way you would make in shul. But the Ashkenazim, many of them have the minhag to say lishma Megillah. It's a big dispute. The Vilna Gaon says you should stick to the old bracha anyway, like the Shulchan Aruch says. But anyway, you shouldn't be surprised if you hear somebody make a bracha l'shma Megillah. That's where it comes from. It comes from the Rambam. How about the bracha after the Megillah is over? So we know on Purim night, not on Purim day, on Purim night we make a bracha, which is a very long paragraph that we say after the Megillah is finished being read. The Gemara says this is a birchas hashvach v'hodah. We never make a bracha after we shake the lulav. We don't make a bracha. After we do all the other mitzvahs, we don't make brachas afterwards. So why do we make a bracha here? The answer is, now that we've just read the Megillah and we're so overwhelmed by the story and we're so grateful for the great celebration that happened in the days of Shushan and the fact that all of us were saved, so now we make not a birchas ha-mitzvah. We're not making a bracha because of the mitzvah. We're making a bracha because we have shvach v'hoda. We say thank you to the Ribono Shel Olam for the great miracle that transpired thousands of years ago. And that bracha is supposed to be said as a persume nisa, to publicize the nes. We want to talk about it, we want everyone to be excited. And therefore, it says clearly that if you don't have a minion of people that are listening to the Megillah, so let's say I come home and I lay in the Megillah just for my wife, so then it's not appropriate to say that bracha after the Megillah is finished being read because you don't have a crowd of people. If you have at least 10 people, men or women, who have not yet heard the Megillah, and now you're doing a new reading for them, so then you make that bracha. But if not, then the bracha afterwards should not be recited. A very sensitive question that comes up every year, and I think we don't give enough attention to it, is that what's the story with bringing children to shul? So it's very nice to bring our children to shul, but it's very unfair to bring children to shul if they don't know how to allow the rest of us to hear every word of the Megillah. We have an obligation to hear the words of the Megillah. And again, this question is asked every year also. What happens if kids made noise and I couldn't hear? The answer is everybody should come to shul with a chumash, with a Megillah, and follow along. If you miss any of the words, Shulchan Aruch writes clearly, quoting Gemara Maseches Megillah, if you miss any of the words, just read it along in the chumash and catch up to wherever the Baal Kori is up to. And when you catch up, you just continue to listen from where he's up to. You don't have to hear every word from the klaf. The Gemara says you have to hear most of it from the klaf. So if you miss a word here or there, you could just make it up by reading it in your chumash alone. You don't have to worry, you don't have to go hear it again. But it's complicated when you bring children to shul. In fact, the Berhetev writes in Shulchan Aruch, although there's an age-old practice quoted in the Rama himself, that the kids used to come to shul and bang Haman with the rocks they used to do it with, and then they had all kinds of things that they would do when Haman's name was mentioned, the Berhetev says, I think that I'm going to stop the minhag. The Berhetev is on the page in Shulchan Aruch, because he said it led to so many people not being able to be yotze the mitzvah Megillah. Because every time Haman's name was mentioned, there was so much noise in the shul, and we couldn't get everyone calmed down, and by the time the Baal Kori continued, nobody was listening. And we all know this to be true. So we have to be careful and mindful of the fact that when we are in shul to hear the Megillah, it's our responsibility to know whether or not our children are going to disturb others, and if they will, we have to be careful not to bring them to shul. It is also worth mentioning that the Shulchan Aruch says in Hilchas Megillah that one is not allowed to talk from the beginning of when the Megillah starts being read until the conclusion of the entire Megillah. Which really means you shouldn't talk from the time when the brachos are said until the brachos are finished after the Megillah is over. This is one complete package. And the simple understanding of why one is not allowed to talk is because, number one, we're in the middle of doing a mitzvah, but number two, the Labush says if you're going to be talking, you're obviously not going to be able to hear. That's just basic logic. And therefore, he says one should be careful not to interrupt at all in the middle of this mitzvah by talking, because we're concerned that maybe you're going to miss some of the words of the Megillah, and therefore you're going to have to go and listen to it again if you have a hefsek and you forgot to hear those words from the Baal Kori. What about the question that comes up every year? Is one able to have a Mikra Megillah over the telephone? It's a very good question. I get this question literally every year. There's always a member of the community who is not well and is therefore not able to have participation in shul itself, but they want to hear the Megillah, which is a very good thing to do, and they're not able to make it out of their homes. So generally we assume, Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes, that we assume that hearing the Megillah over a telephone is really not going to be sufficient. And that goes also, once we're talking about this, I should mention as well, I can't tell you how many people here have mentioned to me that they have elderly mothers who live in other communities on Matzah Shabbos. They don't want to make Havdalah because they're afraid of this old myth of growing a beard. If you say Havdalah, I don't know where this came from. So very often their children will call them on Matzah Shabbos, which is a very respectful and wonderful thing to do, to call your parents on Matzah Shabbos. I try to do it as well. But they make Havdalah over the phone for their elderly mothers. That really is very questionable. And I have advised all the people who have asked me that you should just encourage your mother to make Havdalah on her own. There's nothing wrong with a woman making her own Havdalah if she has no other option. The Shulchan Aruch says that we officially assume that really women are obligated in Havdalah equally to the obligation of men. It's a big machlokas harishonim, but the real opinion in Shulchan Aruch is that women share the obligation with men. And therefore, if a woman is alone in her home, and the only option is for her to hear over the phone or for her to start going to neighbors, she doesn't have to make herself so uncomfortable to start knocking on the neighbors' doors to make Havdalah. She has every right to make Havdalah on her own. And that's certainly the better thing to do. To hear on the phone is a very, very questionable thing to do. Somebody asked the question last night at the shir, which I thought was a very good one. Such a good question, the Gemara even asked it. Why do we not say Halal on Purim? Such a celebratory day, everyone's so excited. Why is there no Halal? Like, it's a blatant omission. We say it every other Yom Tov. Why is there no Halal on Purim? So the Gemara actually gives two reasons, and with this we will close. Answer number one, says the Gemara, is because Kriyasa Zuhi Halela. When we read the Megillah, that is the Halal. We are thanking HaKadosh Baruch Hu for the miracle. And in the Megillah, we read about how happy and how grateful we are and how the celebration was instituted because of the miracle. That is the Halal. That's better than Halal. We recount the entire story and we're grateful for everything that happened back then. So that's one answer. And based on that, the Meiri, one of the Gedolei HaRishonim, said, if you live in a community where they don't have a Megillah, or you don't have a Baal Kori who knows how to read the Megillah, everyone should get up and say Halal. Okay. So we don't follow that opinion. But it's interesting. That's what the Meiri draws from the Gemara. It seems that the Megillah is in place of Halal. Therefore, if you live in a community which doesn't have the opportunity to lay in a Megillah, you should actually say Halal. That's one opinion in the Gemara. Second opinion in the Gemara is, what do we say in Halal? We begin the Halal by saying, Hallelujah, Avdei Hashem. We are so grateful to be your servants. We are so grateful to have the mitzvos. So says the Gemara. It makes sense when we came out of Mitzrayim. We thank Hashem for now being Avdei Hashem. We used to be Avdei Paro, and now we were liberated, now we were saved, and now we become Avdei Hashem. We morphed into a nation and became the followers of the Ribono Shel Olam. So we thank Him by saying, Hallelujah, Avdei Hashem. However, over here, says the Gemara, what are you going to say? Even after the Purim story ended, Akati Avdei Achashverosh Hanan. Purim was a very unusual Yom Tov. Purim happened in the diaspora, and after the story finished, we remained there. Achashverosh was still the king. And we still didn't have our own land, and we still didn't go back to do the Avodah and the Beis HaMikdash. We remained there, and we're still in Golus. So what are we going to say? We're going to get up on Purim and say, thank you so much for the great celebration of Purim, and after all, after we were saved, we became Avdei Hashem? Not really. We remained Avadim to the host country where we were. And therefore the Gemara says that is the reason why Halal is not recited on Purim, because we don't have a complete celebration. Although we're very happy on Purim, and there's great reason to celebrate, we have to understand on Purim we are still Galus Jews. And as perfect as we think life is, life needs to feel deficient for us. We need to understand that this is not the way life needs to be lived. Life is supposed to be lived with a geula, with the Beis HaMikdash, focusing our attention on being Avdei Hashem. And until we have that, says the Gemara, how can we say Hallel? We are not completely freed. We are not completely celebrating because we don't find ourselves having the ultimate celebration that a Jew is supposed to have. Yes, question.